Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, how you get to work, the calories you burn, and whether livable cities really means life and health. And a response to last week's program on the draft guidelines for men and their doctors about prostate cancer screening. We reiterated the line often heard on the Health Report that the PSA blood test is a pretty lousy investigation and men need to be carefully advised before they have it. The reason being that if the level is high, then you're on a path which includes multiple biopsies, a lot of uncertainty, and maybe unnecessary surgery. Well, a radiologist, Dr. Rob Parkinson at the Wesley Hospital in Brisbane, heard the show and reckoned the guideline was already out of date. Rob pointed to new research that he and a leading Brisbane urologist, Dr. Les Thompson, have recently published internationally. It looked at MRI scanning of the prostate and could be a game changer which makes men's decision making with a general practitioner much easier. Here's urologist Les Thompson.
We've had an unsatisfactory situation really since PSA was introduced in 1990. Just recently we've had three major studies, that's one from the United States, one from Canada and one from the NHMRC, that all come to the same conclusion, that basically PSA testing may result in incremental benefits to patients, but the harms of testing outweigh the benefits.
And the harms being that you've got to operate on quite a lot of men for one man's life to be saved over a period of time.
Correct, yes. There was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago that mentioned the figure 48, but other studies have had sort of slightly less numbers. The harms are mainly overdiagnosis, overtreatment, and the complications of the overtreatment. But running parallel with this was the fact that patients and GPs and urologists perceive a benefit in PSA testing, and that benefit is that early diagnosis gives them the opportunity for definitive treatment and the hope of a cure. So even in spite of the fact that we've been advised not to do it, it's still occurring.
And you in your recent paper also outlined the fact that it's not just the PSA that's got a problem, it's the biopsy that follows it if it's raised.
Right. Well, we've always blamed the PSA. But in around 2011, I was in the Netherlands and I saw a research radiology team produce some beautiful pictures of the prostate. At that stage, I'd been in practice for about 30 years and I had never seen anything like this. And so I thought to myself, perhaps our problem with prostate is that we're basing our diagnostic pathway on multiple biopsies, whereas in every other solid organ in the human body, it's done on imaging and targeted biopsies.
So, for example, you do a mammogram on a woman and you find a lump and then you go off and biopsy it after that rather than doing multiple needle biopsies in the breast hoping to find the lump.
Correct. And that applies to everything else, like, you know, kidney, brain, everything.
And the prostate's curious because you can have little buds of cancer all over the place.
I think if you put needles into the kidney or any other organ, you'd find the same thing as well. But it's never been done before.
And you also argue that pathologists don't necessarily agree with what they see down the microscope, this histology that you're talking about.
There's difficulty in interpretation of biopsy findings. Pathology is quite subjective. It's not an objective thing.
So your revelation on the road to Damascus was a revelation on the road to the Netherlands.
Correct.
So what did you do after you saw these MRI pictures of the prostate?
I was quite impressed with these. And the thing that was interesting about that conference was that after the professor of radiology had presented these pictures, there was a lot of apprehension from the people, mainly Americans and some Germans. And he defended himself very well. And he had the evidence, the pictures, which were very good.
And what were the pictures? The pictures were of they could detect cancer quite well?
Very well. So anyway, what happened was I came home, was pretty impressed. So I spoke to the radiologists in our department and my colleague Rob Parkinson and I, we travelled to Holland and spent a week with him and we were pretty impressed. And he was at that stage looking for someone to do a study where we could actually test the biopsy-driven pathway versus the image-driven pathway for diagnosis of men with PSAs that hadn't had biopsies before. And so, to cut a long story short, we were able to achieve that in Australia.
So tell me about the study that you did.
We had 223 men, all with PSAs that were either concerning or high, that had been sent by their GPs to urologists and then by the urologist to the trial. And instead of doing biopsy straight away, we imaged them. If we saw any suspicious lesions, we put them back in the MRI machine and I did a targeted biopsy of the lesion. And then I got another urologist blinded to the original diagnosis and the MRI to come in and do a standard truss biopsy. So in effect, every patient was his own control.
And truss means transrectal ultrasound guided. So you put an ultrasound probe in the rectum and then you guide your needles into the prostate that way.
Correct, yeah. That's the standard of care around the world at the moment. And we did 12 biopsies, which was the standard of care.
And what did you find?
The first thing we found was that only about 50% of people in our sample needed a biopsy at all. In other words, if we imaged the patient first, 50% of men could avoid having any biopsy at all.
Because there was nothing suspicious there.
Correct. The second thing, and probably the most important thing, is the diagnosis of low-risk cancer, that's the cancer that you die with rather than of, was decreased by 89.4%, nearly 90%.
And why was that? Because you were only going for the lumps that looked promising?
Yes, that's right. We were finding on the random truss biopsies lots of little bits of cancer, which we simply didn't see on the MRI. So the MRI was, in fact, acting as a biomarker to separate out intermediate and high-risk cancer versus low-risk cancer.
But when you followed these men, if you'd not done the biopsies, would you have missed something?
Did we miss something? Yes, we did miss some. In the trial, there were a few missed. The sensitivity of the pathway was about 92% and the negative predictive value was 96%. So
what does that mean?
It's an estimate of the accuracy of the test for picking up the cancer. So some patients were missed on the image-based pathway, but on the biopsy-based pathway, a lot more patients were missed.
Oh, really?
Mm. Because the truss biopsies are random, the truss biopsy pathway had a sensitivity rate of around about 70%, whereas the image-based pathway, it was 92%. In other words, the MRI was more effective in picking up significant cancer.
So this means then, I assume, that you were also being more efficient in the men who were going forward for either radiotherapy or operation?
Correct, yes.
Now, this form of MRI scanning is not reimbursable under Medicare at the moment.
Correct.
I think it costs about $500. What was the cost-benefit? Potentially, this could be quite expensive or there could be a trade-off. What does it look like when you look at the costs?
This has actually been worked out. It was done in the Netherlands using some of our data, and the results of that was that the image-guided pathway in itself is cost-effective and also improves the quality of life. That wasn't even counting the additional cost savings that occur because of reduced interventions, which will occur because we don't find the non-life-threatening cancer.
And the quality of life was because you weren't operating and causing incontinence or erectile dysfunction, and also you weren't causing worry because the man got the answer pretty much straight up.
Correct. It's easy to say that PSA could also be called prostate-specific anxiety. And by just imaging straight away reduces that anxiety considerably.
So tell me how your urologist colleagues are taking this news. Some have been using MRI scanning already,
yep.
But how are urologists as a group taking this news?
Well, I think the word is apprehensive because it's a generational change. We've been using the same treatment algorithm since 1990, so that's 24 years. Any generational change is going to be problematic. Also, there's a learning curve on a number of levels for MRI. First of all, the urologist has to learn how to read them, to understand the technique and to read them. We need to also learn how to do image-guided biopsies, which is a new technique.
How do you do that with an MRI scanner where you can't use metal?
We use titanium needle with gadolinium strips in.
And what about radiologists? Because anecdotally, there are only probably two or three radiologists in each major city who are good at this.
Yeah, I think this will come. I think it's just a matter of developing it. At the moment, there's a slight catch-22 because they don't want to spend the money in development until there's a rebate, but they won't get a rebate until their quality control methods are demonstrable. So at the moment, urologists and radiologists have to become best friends. Mm-hmm. We have to stop any concept of a turf war and look after each other and develop this really for the good of the men.
Because the radiologist can do the biopsy now rather than the urologist.
They certainly could, yeah.
So Les Thompson, you also argue now that when I interviewed Bruce Armstrong last week on the Health Report, we reiterated the issue that we've talked about many times before, which is the key decision is whether or not to have your PSA test. Once you've had the PSA test, you're on the train and you've got to have all these things done. You argue now that if you use MRI, the importance of that first decision is much less.
Correct. The PSA, in my opinion, is an alarm bell only. It's a very non-specific test, and all it means is something may be wrong with the prostate. The commonest cause of a raised PSA is benign prostatic enlargement, so it's very non-specific. So if you substitute an image-based diagnostic pathway, that is, you take a picture first before you put 12 needles in, then basically it takes the problem out of the PSA argument. And in fact, I think what's been happening is we've been spending 25 years looking at the wrong question. The wrong question was, should I have a PSA? The right question is, if I have an elevated or worrying PSA, should I have high volume random biopsies? Well, embarrassingly to me, who's been doing high volume random biopsies for 25 years, the answer is probably no. Now that we have more information and new knowledge, we should be having an image first. And this brings prostate cancer in line with every other solid organ in the body. The thing is, I think we're lucky to have the PSA because what it does, it's a discriminator, it's an alarm bell. And if the alarm bell doesn't go off, well then you're fairly safe. Not completely safe, but fairly safe.
Brisbane-based urologist Dr. Les Thompson, and we'll have the reference to his and Rob Parkinson's paper on the Health Report's website. You're listening to RN, and I'm Norman Swan. It makes sense that our choices in terms of how we get to work and travel on a daily basis can affect our health. But it hasn't been very well documented, which is why Melbourne general practitioner Dr. Margaret Beavis did her own study.
We know that physical activity has enormous health benefits. A couple of years ago, the World Health Organization looked at what was going to improve population health and described physical activity as a best buy because it improved so many illnesses and prevented so many illnesses. The real background for me is that as a general practitioner, I see people with blood pressure, diabetes, depression, cholesterol, kidney disease, and for all of these people, I'm saying go and exercise. And so I was trying to factor in the health benefits of the day-to-day exercise that people get just moving around, travelling around. What is the value of people taking active transport rather than travelling by car or private vehicle?
So what did you do in the study?
The Victorian Department of Transport did a very nice survey of about 30,000 people in Melbourne. They looked at how people travelled on a particular day to see how much exercise they did. I took that data and sifted out how much exercise they did. I then looked at what the health impacts of that was.
So you looked at this information on 30,000 Victorians about how they went to work each day and, and how they travelled around. And what you were trying to find out was just how much exercise was involved in the various type of transport.
Yes, indeed.
So let's take driving the car. What sort of incidental exercise was that?
Well, if you were very generous in how you calculated it, the maximum people were averaging was 10 minutes a day.
To and from the car?
To and from the car.
Tram?
We shifted it into public transport in general. So tram, train, bus were all included together. For people who used public transport, people who drove to the station or to the bus, they got about half an hour a day, 31 minutes. People who walked to the station from home or to the bus or to the tram, got about 41 minutes a day, which is very impressive given that we know that 30 minutes a day has really significant health benefits. It reduces premature death rate by between 20 and 22% and helps an enormous number of other illnesses. Walkers and cyclists, which we combined together, averaged about 38 minutes a day. So once again, they did extremely well. They met the 30 minutes recommended level of physical activity each day that we know gives these enormous health benefits.
But not as much as people who walk to the station or the tram stop.
No, which was surprising.
And is that because they where they live?
Well, the other thing that we looked at was, in fact, who in which suburb was travelling the most. We looked at the outer suburbs, middle, inner, and then inner city. And we found that people in the outer suburbs, largely because they're reduced public transport availability and also the spread out of the destinations makes the car really the main travel option for most trips. So, in fact, people in the inner suburbs were six times more likely to get their 30 minutes of exercise a day compared to people in the outer suburbs. And this also has health impacts at a population level.
And, of course, it's our outer suburbs where overweight and obesity is at its worst.
Indeed. Although it's worth remembering that with one of the reasons the World Health Organization was so keen on physical activity is that being more physically active works in the overweight and obese. It improves their health outcomes even if they stay obese and overweight, and similarly works in the elderly. So it's quite a encouraging thing in that if you can get people to get off the couch and start exercising, even just walking to get to work, that will really improve their health outcomes.
And did you look at the downsides of public transport, such as getting off the tram in the middle of the street and a car passing you by and knocking you over?
I'm afraid the Department of Transport data didn't include that.
But didn't include the car accidents in Toorak Road.
No, indeed.
So you're kind of telling us what I suppose we know, but it just emphasises this. And presumably the postcode issue corrects for people's level of education, because level of education tends to go up the closer you are to our modern cities.
Yes.
And wealth, if you like.
Yes, yes. Before you factored in age, occupation, income, it was roughly three times that inner city people would get three times more likely. But once you factored in age, occupation and income, it became that six times figure. So that the inner city, inner density people were so much more likely to get that physical activity that was so important.
So whilst you want the fresh air of the outer suburbs, in fact, the inner city is the healthier place to be.
From an incidental activity point of view, indeed.
Did the data differentiate between people who were in employment and people who were retirees?
When you looked at the differences between those people, there was really no significant difference, that the amount of physical activity that they got didn't vary with whether they were retirees or whether they were employed. What did vary was whether they were, for instance, labourers who presumably drove a car much more because they were carrying their tools, or whether they were professional drivers like taxi drivers. That group clearly got much less physical activity. The other thing that fell out of the data that was interesting was that if your car was paid for by work, you were less likely to get physical activity. So in some ways, having your car paid for by work became a little bit of a health hazard as well.
Now, you calculated the gross benefits of this in terms of deaths and money saved.
Yes. We did some modelling, which if 10% of car users started using public transport, then annually that potentially could save 89 lives and avoid almost 300 cases of disease, so in terms of prevention, and save about $10.5 million in health and productivity costs. So that was just if you got people out of the car and got more people using public transport. And similarly, if you compared the daily travel in people in the outer suburbs and then gave them patterns similar to those people in the inner city, again, in terms of just prevention, you could annually save about 270 lives, avoid about 900 cases of disease, and save about $35 million in health sector and production costs.
And weighed against the investment in public transport, which is considerable, I mean, it costs a lot of money for an extra few kilometres of rail track or tram track.
It does indeed. With economic modelling, health economists are by their very nature pretty conservative. These figures valued a human life at 3 months' income. So that's the societal cost of someone dropping dead, which is 3 months to re-employ them. So these were pretty tough numbers in terms of...
So the real gains are much higher.
Much higher, and it depended on the type of modelling you used. The other thing to remember in terms of real gains, that this is just looking at prevention of disease, doesn't look at all the health benefits of the treatment of these diseases. I mean, so many of these diseases, you get people to exercise and they improve, and that would also have major health benefits that are not measured by this economic model.
And of course, the implication here is, of course, if you've got to take, if you walk to the bus or tram or train and you spend almost another hour exercising to and from, that your trip to work is longer, but that's not necessarily true, because you didn't factor into, I presume you didn't factor in the length of the trip time into that, because if you're sitting in a traffic jam on the freeway, Southeastern Freeway all day, it's not necessarily faster.
No, and for people who have to sort of spend an extra half an hour going to the gym, if you factor that into your getting to work, it's often quite time efficient. It might take you 10 minutes longer or 15 minutes longer, but if it saves you having to spend an hour going to the gym in the day, it's actually quite time efficient.
Yeah, I'm feeling jealous of all those people with perfect bodies.
I don't know if this will give you a perfect body, but it'll give you a much better health outcome.
Margaret Beavis, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So that was Margaret Beavis, a general practitioner in Melbourne, doing that study, fascinating study, on public transport and how you get to work each day or how you travel around each day. And with me on the line from Melbourne is Billy Giles-Corti. Billy has been studying livable cities for a long time and health and urban planning. I think I first interviewed you, Billy, when you were at the University of Western Australia.
Yes, and we've met up in Queensland. We've had a few connections along the way.
So tell me about this study that you're about to embark on, because you're trying to get urban planners to really get some metrics in when you're designing a city for health.
Yeah, this builds on a lot of work that we've been doing, working with planners, transportation planners, trying to sort of get to measure the way the built environment affects people's health and well-being. And in this case, what we're doing is trying to speak directly to what they're interested in. Around the world, people, planners, are interested in creating livable cities. So what we're trying to do here is to look at livability through a health lens. So we've defined health through a social determinants of health lens, and that is allowing us then to create metrics that not only speak to planners, because we're talking about livability, but also allows us to speak to public health people, and we're going to be measuring different aspects of livability that impact chronic disease.
And when you say social determinants, you mean what?
all the things that create the conditions for good health. We often focus on health behaviour, and we know that it's better to have healthy behaviours. But actually, why is it that people behave the way they do? Now, some people choose to, and there's no question that there's a matter of choice. But some people make choices from the limited choices that they have available. And what we're interested in doing is understanding those factors about the choices that people have, and then trying to optimise and work with policymakers who can change those conditions to make it easier to people to act on good intentions, or to make it easier just to choose a healthy choice rather than the unhealthy choice.
So how important, just going to Margaret Beavis's study there on the mode of transport and how much incidental exercise you get, how important is transport in all this?
It's really critical. It really underpins. Everyone should have the right to a multimodal. By that I mean a multimodal system is one where people could choose to walk, they could choose to cycle, they could choose to use public transport, or they could choose to drive. Now, to me, that is a right that people should have, and that does affect the choices people make in terms of the transportation choices. So if you're someone living on the urban fringe, the only choice you really have is to drive, because often there is no place to walk to, there's no shops and services, there is no frequent public transport system. It does make a big difference, the decisions we make about policy, and they do create the conditions for people to choose a healthy choice or an unhealthy choice, in this case, transportation.
And how closely are you going to connect to the economics? A few days ago when I was presenting Late Night Live, I had Peter Newman on from Curtin University, a renowned urban planner, who says we're outdated when we say that really roads are the only thing we're going to fund out of the public purse, because people want and need public transport to get into our main cities for the brain-based industries, if you like, of the future.
I think Peter's completely right. What the future really holds for us is a transportation system, which is about the alternatives, walking, cycling, public transport use. That's what people need and want.
So you're arguing there's a synchrony with economics and health.
Absolutely. We haven't done this yet. We've got a Centre of Excellence on Healthy Livable Communities, which has been funded by the National Health and Medical Research Council. And in that, what we include is a focus on how much of these built environment interventions do we need? So how much public transport would encourage people to use public transport or to use the alternative? And then what's the economics of that? So we have embedded in our study an understanding of what the built environment interventions need to be, and we're going to look at the economics. I don't have the evidence now, but I'm confident that Peter's right.
So when you see these international league tables and they say Melbourne's the most livable city, then next year it's Sydney, and you know, whatever the statistic might be, but Australian cities often do quite well. What are their metrics when you get these league tables internationally?
Well, the league tables, there's the Economist Intelligence Unit, and that clearly puts Melbourne as one of the most livable cities in the world, or the most livable city in the world. And then there's been the recent
one. What are their metrics?
There's the same as the OECD, the Better Life Index. What they use is the sorts of things that we're using. So they'll use things like how safe the community is, whether people have access to affordable housing. They'll ask about access to education. But what they do is they look at whole cities and they don't look within cities. It's not to say that Melbourne is not going to, in some parts of Melbourne are entirely livable. If you live in inner Melbourne, it is a fantastic place to live. There's fantastic public transport. There's wonderful green space. But what we're drawing with our lens is taking a health lens, so we're actually putting
right into
additional
the new
things.
Greenfield sites and the outer limits of Melbourne, which have been opened up controversially.
That's right. And we're looking at things like access to healthy food, access to alcohol outlets as well, access to public open space, because we know that that encourages people to be more physically active and also good for mental health. So we're looking at the detail. It's a spatial measure. And then we'll be able to unpick where things are going well and where things are not so going well. And we're going to be able to compare Australian cities between one another with a common metric, which is spatial. And we're also going to be able to look within cities to identify areas where there may be problems. And the beauty of it is that we're going to tie it to policy. So all of our measures are tied to what current policy is. We're looking at all the states where we're working. We're looking at five states and territories, and we've unpacked the policy. We say, well, what's the policies here? We're going to say, well, which policies are working best? So in WA, there might be one policy on public open space. They say that 10% of land needs to be allocated to public open space, whereas in Melbourne, they say that everyone
WA,
should live.
WA, the policy is we'll have as big a city as we possibly can, or as least densely populated, relying on the car more and more. I mean, WA's Perth a disaster.
To be honest, Norman, are we really? Melbourne's also building at 15 houses per hectare on the urban fringe. We have a problem with our densities. In fact, Perth now has its livable neighbourhood guidelines. We've just done a 10-year evaluation of it, and they're getting up to 19 houses per hectare. We really think that to be able to create a walkable environment at the very, very, very minimum, and I'm talking very minimum, you really need about 22 houses per hectare, and we're building in Melbourne at 15. So I think we have some significant problems in the way we're approaching our planning at the moment. We do need to increase our densities, and I think there needs to be a grown-up conversation in Australia about that. And I'm not talking about high rise. I'm talking about densities that allow us to have all the amenity that creates a good life, access to public open space, but access to shops and services, good public transport, having services like community services, health services nearby. We should be able to have those sorts of things, but we can't when we're, as in Perth, 170 kilometres long.
Just finally, when you've got this set of measures together in this multidisciplinary centre that you've developed, what's going to happen then? Are you just going to advocate and try and convince ministers for planning in an increasingly centralised planning environment what to do?
Well, this project's been funded by the Australian Prevention Partnership Centre, and it's great because it does bring together all the health departments in all the states that are being funded. New South Wales, ACT have got the health departments involved. We've got the Victorian one as well. And so what we'll be able to do is
That's separate from urban planning.
Yeah, but in addition to that, through our Centre of Excellence in Healthy Livable Communities, what we've established in three of the states that we're working, Western Australia, Queensland and Victoria, all the major players are around the table. We have the Metropolitan Planning Authorities, the Departments of Planning, Departments of Transport. They are all part of our advisory groups, and so we're working at often at very senior levels. We're feeding back the information to them, and I think they're looking with great interest at this. They're all interested in livability. That is something that is no doubt of interest across Australia. They're all concerned that we might find something that they don't want to find, of course. But,
I still remember I was chairing an obesity summit in Queensland.
And
were you there? I don't know if you were there, but they started talking about the design of suburbs in southeast Queensland, showing that people who lived in those kinds of suburbs were 6 kilos heavier than people lived in mixed development suburbs, and the whole conversation was shut down by the planning minister. So we've still got a way to go.
I think we have, but actually I think people are starting to recognise now that it's not a departmental thing. It's actually, the fact is, it's a whole of government problem. And we can't solve any of these problems like the obesity epidemic if we don't take a whole of government approach. And it's the government's budget, it's the Australians' budget that we're dealing with, not the planning minister's budget or the transport minister's budget. It's the whole of government budget that's going to cause the problem. So I think people are starting to realise that we can't take the siloed approach to obesity and health problems, because otherwise the health budget's going to overtake the whole state budget, as some states have demonstrated, if we don't curb some of these chronic diseases and the obesity epidemic. So my sense is that people are starting to listen. We're certainly getting a lot of traction with our Centre of Excellence, and I think through the Australian Partnership Prevention Partnership Centre, we're also doing the same thing, that people are starting to take interest in this. So I don't think that what we're doing is sitting on the outside. I think we're actually almost embedded, and I think the question is the way we present it to people, because it's not to criticise, it's really just to find a solution.
Billy Giles Corti, thank you very much. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Norman.
Professor Billy Giles Corti is Director of the Mackaykee Centre for Community Wellbeing at the University of Melbourne. This has been the Health Report. I'm Norman Swan, and I'll see you next week.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, and you know what that means? Well, yes, more Bing Crosby than is healthy, plus the Sunday Extra podcast, First Dog on the Moon, Christmas Panto. This year starring Mark Colvin, Virginia Trioli, Sarah Ferguson, and a special guest appearance from Mark Scott as Tiny Tim. You can stream or download the program from the RN website.